This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we begin today at the Water's Edge in Boston, right past Logan Airport, a corner of Eastie, Revere, and Winthrop.
Right outside of the Orient Heights train yard, Boston Harbor on one side and Belle Isle Marsh on the other side, where there's a maintenance yard where they fix all the Blue Line trains.
That's WBUR's Simone Rios. He recently went to Belle Isle Marsh as part of WBUR's series Boston Underwater, which is airing this week. The Marsh is a stop along the T's Blue Line, which features a mile-long tunnel that travels underwater and connects the North Shore with Boston's downtown. But as sea levels rise along Boston's coast, the Belle Isle Marsh is sort of bellwether, the last thing standing between the ocean and maybe the end of the Blue Line as we know it. WBUR's Simone Rios joins us now to talk more about this. Welcome back, Simone.
Hey, Tiziana.
So we started with the scene. You go to Belle Isle Marsh. What does that look like today, and what do we think it's going to look like in the future?
You know, I'd heard a lot of people talk about Belle Isle Marsh over the years, but as a native Bostonian, I never actually went there until I went three times for this story. So it really depends on what time of day you go there, where the tide's at. When it's a stormy, you know, high tide kind of situation, it begins to look more like a bay, an estuary. And, you know, then I went back at a calmer time, and it really looks kind of like your prototypical Eastern Massachusetts marsh, very calm one of the days I was there. What you don't see that experts do see, for example, is how the bird population is changing. There's a salt marsh sparrow that's actually endangered, and its only habitat is in marshland. And ornithologists say there's really not much they can do to turn things around for this bird. And people at Belle Isle Marsh say the bird is kind of a canary in the coal mine for the marsh itself.
So these bellwethers, as we say. So, you know, a saltwater marsh, corner of Boston, doesn't seem like the most significant piece of the climate change puzzle, but it kind of is a pretty big deal, as I understand it. So bring it home for us. What's the threat to the spot and then elsewhere along the Blue Line?
Yeah, so one activist I talked to at Belle Isle Marsh said the marsh is a giant sponge that serves as a barrier between the ocean and the Blue Line, and particularly this Orient Heights car yard where the T works on all the Blue Line trains. So if the marsh goes away, the facility is facing ocean on both sides, and there's nothing to stop storm surges from overtaking the facility.
And that repair facility, therefore, may not be there in the long run. What's the T saying about the facility?
Yeah, so the T recently completed a vulnerability assessment of the Orient Heights car yard. They looked out 40 years when sea levels are expected to be several feet higher than they are now. And under that scenario, a really bad storm could shut down the car yard and the whole Blue Line, actually. The report pointed out that basically all the equipment in the yard needs to be elevated if the facility is going to stand a chance against a severe storm. But the T says they're committed to doing what it takes to keep the Blue Line and the car yard in their current form.
So, Simone, hang tight. I'm going to bring in another voice here. Julie Wormser is the deputy director at the Mystic River Watershed Association. Julie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Julie, in your work, given what you research, just how dire is the situation for the Blue Line with sea level rise?
Well, when the Blue Line was first built, the probability was zero that it would be knocked out by high tide. And at some point, maybe before the end of the century, rising tide mean that we won't be able to protect the subway system from flooding twice a day at high tide. So it's really a question of not if, but when.
Now, you mentioned to our producers that, you know, maybe a long-term solution to the future of the Blue Line is not making it a subway at all, but replacing it with a special rapid transit bus line. Why do that, and what would that look like?
Well, climate change resilience is really a question of how do we keep our current infrastructure going as long as possible, And then there's going to be some point at which it's just much too expensive to try to keep shoring up the same thing. At that point, you can say, do we do another big dig and create another flood-prone subway? Or do we totally rethink this and make a lot of lemonade from one big lemon that is coastal flooding? The idea of bus rapid transit is, imagine the Green Line without the trolley tracks. You pay at a station not on the bus and the entire side of the bus opens. It would still have a dedicated lane to avoid traffic. But unlike the subway or even a trolley, it can easily both move out of harm's way, but it can also easily change or add routes as populations and the economy change.
So Julie, you sound like, if I understand you correctly, you're arguing 100% this is the type of choice that we face. It is just a matter of when.
It is. I mean, just like COVID, we would never have asked for COVID. And yet the dramatic upset it caused is having us rethink some things that will hopefully make us more flexible, more humane, and more equal. It's teed up that conversation. Climate change, so many people have said, is COVID on steroids. And we have the opportunity to not only rebuild, but make things better.
Sorry, I almost interrupted you there. I'm going to turn back to you for a second, Simone. So Julie's just laid out a vision of rethinking something like a rapid transit bus line. How viable of a solution is that? And again, understanding Julie is saying eventually something like that's going to have to happen. Put it in perspective in terms of how essential the Blue Line is to commuters, to the city, to the region.
Look, my sense is that the T isn't really interested in talking about a post-Blue Line future, although there is a sense that Mother Nature is going to have her way. So I think Julie is on the forefront of talking about new ways of thinking about the future of the Blue Line and transit more generally and on the North Shore. And I think that perspective needs to be part of the conversation about the region's transit future. As to the vitality of the Blue Line, before the pandemic, the T says it transported almost 70,000 workers each weekday into Boston, delivering them to basically every industry that keeps this city going. That went way down with the pandemic, but the decline was significantly less than any other subway line, which points to the importance of the Blue Line to essential services. One guy I talked to as he got home from work in Maverick Station is Milton Souza of East Boston. He works as a landscaper at Harvard. So what he's saying here is that the Blue Line is very important for him. He doesn't own a car, and he doesn't need to because of the Blue Line. So it's hard to overstate how convenient the Blue Line is. If you've ever had to drive from East Boston into the city during rush hour, you'll get a sense of why the Blue Line matters. And it matters to the entire North Shore, more to cities like Lynn, Revere, Everett, Lawrence, which are populated by the largely immigrant workforce that we're talking about.
So, Julie, briefly, what other kinds of shorter and longer term solutions should we be thinking about to protect the marsh and the Blue Line?
That's a really great question. I think the thing about the marsh is, as you were mentioning before, this habitat is so critical for things like shorebirds. Is the last big marsh in Boston Harbor. We would love to see some kind of solution that both enhances and extends the value of the marsh, to keep it from being open ocean as long as possible. And there's a possibility that by creating some high marsh habitat, you could also extend the length of the Blue Line. But I think it's really thinking about this in two stages. And for sure, the T is thinking about this first stage of how do we shore up what we have? And I think what's there in our near future is starting to think about what do we do when it just gets too expensive to keep protecting what we've already built.
And Simone, last question to you. What is the T already doing to mitigate?
you know, they're taking this seriously. They want to protect the Blue Line. I spoke to Hannah Lyons Galante. She's the climate resilience expert at the T, focused on these very issues. And she emphasized that the T is committed to protecting the Blue Line by building barriers. So not, you know, raising up the infrastructure, but by building barriers to keep the water out. Let's hear from her.
If at some point all of this becomes completely unfeasible, we say suffer damages that are so expensive you cannot repair them, you have to adapt. You have to change your a different mode. It is not our intention of changing anything about the Blue Line, because we already have something that works and functions right now.
So Simone Rios, WBUR reporter, and Julie Wormser, deputy director at the Mystic River Watershed Association. This is the latest in our Boston Underwater series. Thanks to both of you for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
We talked with WBUR's Simone Rios as part of our station's ongoing series, Boston Underwater. The Blue Line, and really the whole MBTA system, is facing some pretty clear threat as sea levels continue to rise. And as if that's not enough, the T is also faced with a serious financial crunch. It's still reeling from the pandemic as we attempt to fully reopen the city and the region. Here with us to continue the conversation about all of that is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak, and he will take your calls. If you have a question or a comment about the T for Steve, call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand that you had a chance to hear what we were talking about before the great break. Let me just give you a chance to react to that segment about the Blue Line and the sea level rise threat.
Sure. I had the opportunity to hear, obviously, what was said. And, you know, Blue Line is a really important part of our service. And, I think for us, we've done some pretty extensive work understanding what the threat is. We've made a number of investments to mitigate it. I think this will be an ongoing process, right? Part of it is, what can we do to protect our specific assets? And we are making a number of investments. But part of it also is a much more holistic. What is a threat to the T is also a threat to the communities that we serve. And part of it is working with initiatives like Climate Ready Boston to come up with mitigation measures that protect not only the T's assets, but the community itself.
Steve, how much of your portfolio time, sort of thinking about all the different things to deal with, budgets, new train station repairs, how much of your time and thought are you able to give to something like climate? And what else do you think the T needs to do to help deal with those issues coming down the road? You just gave us a list, but are there other things as well?
Well, it's an integral part of our capital planning process. We are investing this year. We're going to spend $1.75 billion on investing in the system. Next year, we hope to spend $2 billion. And a significant component of that is trying to build things thoughtfully that address not only the hazards we see in the next 10 years, but the next 50 years. So, you know, for instance, I had the opportunity to drive by today. We have a brand new seawall at our Charlestown facility along the Mystic River that is intended to protect that facility for the next 50 years from the potential effects of sea level rise. So it is marbled through everything we do in terms of our capital program and also, you know, how we think about our operations.
You're listening to MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. He will take your questions. If you have questions or comments about the T, join us here on Radio Boston, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Steve, you heard Julie Wormser before the break there, and as I was studying this story, it really made me think about the fact that there is this inherent choice in how we maintain and update a system, to either work with legacy infrastructure or build something new. And that really struck me. We've talked a lot over the last couple of years about projects and priorities for the T, but I don't know if I've ever asked you it that way before. The choices the T has made seem to imply that the emphasis is you work with the legacy infrastructure. Is that right? And is there a vision or a thought about some of this is just going to have to go and we're going to have to do something else?
I mean, I think we have a lot of ability to adapt, particularly with the Blue Line. I think you've seen, as was noted in the piece, We've seen really durable ridership on the Blue Line. You know, relative to some of our other subway lines, it's consistently had the highest on a percentage basis, highest ridership throughout the pandemic. And we are committed to continuing to provide that service. I think it's our challenge to figure out what are the internal investments we need to make to make sure that the system is resilient, that the Blue Line itself is resilient, and then what do we need to do with a broader set of partners to make sure that the community as a whole is resilient. So I do not foresee, I know one of your guests was talking about a bus rapid transit as a replacement. We continue to see the Blue Line as viable for the long term, and we'll continue to invest in it.
Do you think there's any part of our T infrastructure that eventually becomes non-viable given sea level rise and the overall impacts of climate change?
I think we're going to be challenged in some places, but I think, I mean, it's a broader challenge for the Metro Boston region. I don't see any place where the T would unilaterally say some piece of the system would be non-viable. I think that's pretty far down the road. I think we're also getting better at mitigating it and planning for it. You know, we're investing at a much higher level. The problems we've had at Aquarium, you know, we've now taken a number of steps to address that. I think we're trying to be thoughtful now. You know, we have raised some of the utilities at Orient Heights. We are also looking at, you know, as I mentioned, you know, Climate Ready Boston. What are some of the things we can do in East Boston as a whole to protect our infrastructure?
We're going to start shifting gears now to the reopening to post-pandemic life. The phone number here with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you back on the T? Are you coming back to the T? Have you been on the T all along? And what thoughts and questions do you have as our economy begins to return, some part normal, some part new normal, and transportation and public transit are going to be a key piece of that. Join the conversation. So, Steve, with that shifting gears, so recently a $2.35 billion operating budget passes. It commits to restoring service to pre-pandemic levels without fare increases. I know there's a ton of hiring, hundreds of hiring that has to be done, if nothing else. What can you tell us about the timing of the restoration of service to pre-pandemic levels?
We are, we're attempting to get bus service back as fast as we can. It's probably not going to be till later in the year. We are back, by and large, on the subway system to pre-pandemic service. In a couple cases, we're actually offering more service in the middle of the day because we've seen a shift in ridership patterns. On commuter rail, we put a new schedule in place April 5th. We're at about 25% of our pre-pandemic ridership, and we think we've got about the right level of service there. We've also restored service levels on ferry as well. We brought back the Charlestown ferry. We've added some ferries to Hingham and Hull. So we think we're in a pretty good spot in terms of the level of service we're putting out there. We are hiring in an effort to get more service on the Green Line and on bus.
Do you have, like, for each branch or division or dimension of the MBTA, do you have implementation goals, like a date? Okay, we want all transit up by this date. We want buses back fully in service by this date. Are you working to a set of goal dates like that?
We are working. There's not a real specific date on bus, just because we typically do bus schedules every quarter. So as we get new bus drivers, they're either assigned to a route or they're being assigned on almost a daily basis. So for bus service, we're looking to get back to what is kind of full pre-COVID levels by sometime this fall. But I don't have a specific date.
And what do you want people to know, Steve, about safety protocols? Have you made, you know, I remember early in the pandemic us talking about cleaning protocols. We've talked about mask wearing. I'm sure there are ventilation concerns in various riders, you know, cars on the trains or in various buses. What should listeners know about safety measures the MBTA has put in place as people come back to the T?
Sure. I think first it's important, I think, for everyone to remember masking is required on the MBTA per the federal guidelines and also the MBTA's policy. So that's masking for both employees and customers. So we ask that everyone wear a mask on the T. I would note that there is no evidence of any kind of super spreader event associated with transit anywhere in the world. So, you know, I think that's important. We continue to clean our vehicles and disinfect them. I think as, you know, as we evaluate some of the public health guidance out there, we may adapt that in the future, but we are currently still cleaning our vehicles and disinfecting our vehicles. For instance, vehicles are on a daily basis. Touch points at our stations are every 4 hours, so we continue to clean them. I ride it on a regular basis across multiple modes, and I encourage folks when they're comfortable to give it a try. And I also want to acknowledge that there are hundreds of thousands of people who have been riding the T throughout this pandemic, and we've been there to provide the service.
Let's go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to speak with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek, who's here with us on Radio Boston. Rose is on the line from her car. Rose, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, it's so funny. This happened just yesterday. A friend and I were leaving the aquarium. We walk over to a T stop. Now, she does not have a trolley card. So she goes to the machine, and she wants to buy a senior ticket. Well, the machine wants to verify that she is indeed a senior. I understand that. But the only verification they ask for is her Charlie card. She would not be getting a ticket if she had a Charlie card. She would either use her Charlie card or use the machine to add on some money to the Charlie card. So she could not get a senior ticket. She was able to get a regular adult fare. And I just thought, how strange. Why would they ask for a Charlie card to verify her age when she would have one already?
Rose, was this the aquarium tea stop? Do you remember which tea stop it was?
I think she said it was Haymarket.
So stay there, Rose. Let's turn to Steve Poftek. Steve.
Yeah.
Sure. Any type of senior ticket or senior pass is a reduced fare product for seniors, and we do need to go through a verification process initially to issue that ticket. So you would need to go to the Charlie Card store to get that ticket. So that's just administratively how we run that program, as opposed
and
to
so
having
Steve,
it available sort of on demand at a vending machine.
So for listeners who are not familiar, when you say go to the Charlie Card store, what does that mean? Is that an online store? Is that a physical store? Just for listeners who may not know.
Sure. The Charlie Card store is in the concourse at Downtown Crossing between Primark and Macy's. But for you old timers like myself, between Jordan's and Feline's in the underground concourse at Downtown Crossing.
Steve, let's go to another call here. We've got David on the line in Hyde Park. And before we go to David, again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Poftek. Good afternoon. I am a regular commuter rail user. And back in the day, the MBTA used to use bus liners on some of the commuter rail lines. And when I get on the commuter rail in midday, you're filling up one or two cars out of a six-car set. And it's my perception that you're really wearing out the equipment by running these empty cars along these lines. And what are your plans on bringing back self-propelled bud liners or something similar that doesn't require a locomotive and doesn't use a lot of cars that are going to be empty?
Go ahead, Steve.
Great question. We're currently evaluating a couple different service models for the future. One of the ones we're actively evaluating it's not exactly the bud liner, but it is it's called an EMU, and it is a self-propelled vehicle. It obviously would require a whole host of infrastructure upgrades on most of our lines. But it is one of the things we're evaluating as part of the future of commuter rail. Right now, we run locomotives with cars attached. We have reduced the size of many of the train sets we're running as in a response to reduced ridership. If we see ridership uptick, we'll obviously increase the size of it. So it is part of our long-term thinking. But I would, to be completely transparent, long-term is going to be 5 years plus at this point.
So, Steve, in your answer to David there, you talked about infrastructure upgrades, and there are some things there I'd love to talk about while we've got time with you. Let's start with the Green Line. You're working on the D Line. It's shut down until June 20th and then again from the 24th to July 2nd. Mindful that that is essentially the main Red Sox line. They have a bunch of home games during that stretch. Why shut the line down when there's going to be such high demand for it due to those games?
Yeah, shutting the line down is not a decision we take lightly, but it is. It does allow us to get an awful lot more work done. Otherwise, you're in the process of trying to get work done on the overnight. So, let's say the line shuts down potentially 12:30, 1 p.m. or 1 a.m. You set up for an hour, you do an hour or two of work, and then you've got to take it down to get the line restarted again. So to have that 24-hour access to the line is really important to us. We have added additional express buses from Riverside to the Kenmore Square area to try to absorb some of the volume for the Red Sox games. We also, we were expecting August 1st to be more of the reopening time than all of a sudden May 29th was upon us. And, very happily, we joined in the reopening. But recognize that it is an inconvenience for our customers, but we think it's worth it to be able to get a lot more work done to make the line more reliable.
And let's stay with the Green Line for a second, and then after this question, we'll go to another call. The Green Line Extension Project, it has been troubled for years. It was projected to be completed by the end of this year. Are you still expecting to finish it by the end of 2021?
We are currently in discussions with the team that's building it, GLXC, to try to firm up when exactly it's going to be done. So I don't have anything definitive to say on that. I think we're having very productive conversations with them. We want to get that we want to get GLX open as soon as possible because it's going to be a great benefit to our customers, and over the arc of this project, people have been waiting for this for a long time. And we're very close, so we want to get it open as soon as we can.
So it may, but it also may not, depending on what happens in these conversations.
Still working on that conversation, yep.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. We've got Vivian on the line in Maynard. Vivian, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. We actually just recently moved to Maynard and in the process of buying a house the weekend Fitchburg line service was stopped, and which is a big loss for us, just because we had planned on taking the commuter rail quite a bit to get to work and also to get into Boston on the weekends. And so I'm just wondering, it feels like there's kind of this negative feedback.
Oh, Vivian, I think we lost you there. So Steve, let's let Vivian go. Steve, I know the rest of what you wanted to know is restoration of weekend services.
Yes, and Vivian and I have never met, so this is not a setup. We are bringing back weekend service on all the commuter rail lines on July 3rd. So
July 3rd?
Yeah, so service will be back on the weekends on all the lines. I believe it was suspended on 5 of the 12 lines. It will be back, and those schedules, if they're not up right now, they should be up shortly. So pleased to bring that service back.
All right. Well, that's good to know, and I'm now glad you told us Vivian wasn't a plant, since that's news that you're giving us here. All right, Steve, we don't have a ton of time left. There's like 800 other things I'd like to ask you. I think the last thing I will go to is the Fiscal Management Control Board. It'll cease to exist as it's currently constituted at the end of the month. It was formed in 2015 after Snowmageddon, extended for a year. The governor is interested in a new oversight board. What do you want to see, and how essential? I mean, obviously, externally, people think some level of oversight is really important. What's your position on that?
I do think some level of oversight is important. It is an active discussion now at the legislature. The House Ways and Means Committee has put forward a proposal I was one of the founding members of the Fiscal and Management Control Board. I think it, so obviously I'm a little biased. I think it, you know, it's been an extraordinary institution that has brought the MBTA from what was, you know, was a really dire place to a much better place now. And we will see what this legislative process brings us. The Fiscal and Management Control Board sunsets at the end of June. And barring legislation, we'll revert to the MassDOT board. But I am hopeful that we get some sort of definitive outcome from the legislative process.
And let's just talk money briefly. Projections say that once the federal pandemic aid dries up in 2024, the T will have a massive budget shortfall. Is that the most urgent pressure point for the T right now, Steve?
It is among many pressure points. It is among the most urgent. We will be challenged in 2024. I think we have at least a couple years to prepare for that and also to understand what ridership will look like in the future. Ridership will eventually stabilize. We'll eventually work out how many people are hybrid, how many people are commuting, how have commuting patterns changed. And then I think we can work to figure out how to fund this public service. So we have a couple years of runway, but 2024 is going to be a really pivotal time for the MBTA.
And that is Steve Poftak, General Manager of the MBTA. Steve, always grateful for the time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We're going to talk for the rest of the hour about an antique agricultural sack, stained with age and embroidered with an inscription that says, "My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at age 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her it be filled with my love always. She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother." Ruth Middleton, 1921. This sack was featured in the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. from September 2016 to March 2021. It's now on site at the Middleton Place Plantation in Charleston, South Carolina. It's captured countless imaginations, including that of local scholar and historian Taya Miles. Her new book is called All That She Carried. The book uses the sack to thread together Rose and Ashley's history and that of other enslaved women, while underscoring how little of their history we can know. Those who were enslaved were often made invisible in historical and archival records. Taya Miles joins us now, a history professor and Radcliffe alumnae professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Professor Miles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this book was so compelling from the first to the last, and it begins with this discovery for you of Ashley's sack. What originally drew you to it?
I was drawn to the sack when I saw it hanging in the Smithsonian in DC, because it is an incredible piece of material culture, an incredible object that immediately encourages emotional connection. When I saw it, I knew that I couldn't leave it. It was a visceral reaction. I knew that I had to find out more about it and eventually to try to write its story.
Okay, so I'm going to maybe embarrass myself a little bit here, but as you talked about this physical object, right? I've never seen it, but I felt like I wanted to touch it. I wanted to hold it. I wanted to smell it. I wanted to get the feel of it myself. What is it, in looking back in history, that these physical options bring us that is so deeply connected to what happened in the past?
It's a wonderful question. And I think it's a question about objects in the present as well as in the past. Right now, you and I are talking by way of a screen. We live our lives so often, especially during the pandemic, in a distance, in digital space, without being able to see one another face-to-face, to touch one another, to interact in all of the various sensory forms that we were built to interact in. And I think that in this kind of environment, when we are deprived of concreteness of materialism, we are drawn to things that feel real, to things that we can really focus our attention on. And when it comes to historical questions, historical investigation, and historical connection, there's nothing like the material to focus that attention.
So the Sacks journey is a journey of part of American history. Tell us just briefly, where did it travel? Where did it begin? And how did it eventually up at Middleton Place, where it currently resides?
This is one of the many incredible aspects of this story. The Sack itself seems almost charmed. This is a very old utilitarian bag that was originally intended to hold agricultural products such as seeds or flour, that was acquired somehow by an enslaved African-American woman named Rose in 1850s Charleston. Rose got her hands on this sack, and then when she learned that her daughter Ashley was going to be sold away and separated from her, Rose packed this sack with all the items that you read aloud at the start of our conversation. The sack was gifted by Rose to Ashley, and then the mother and daughter never saw one another again. They were separated for the rest of their lives, which is the truly tragic aspect of the story. But Ashley saved the sack. She kept it with her. She cared for it. She tended to it, such that we can see on the sack itself, and this takes us back to a discussion of materiality, patches on the fabric. Ashley kept the sack. She handed it down to her own daughter, Rosa, who handed it down to her own child, Ruth. The family lived in South Carolina for most of their lives, where they had been enslaved, but Ruth, like many, many African Americans in the early 20th century, decided that she would make her way north to find a new life, to find a safer life, to find greater economic opportunity. And she took this precious sack with her. In Philadelphia, Ruth embroidered the sack with the story that we now know. And many years later, the sack turned up in a flea market in Tennessee. A flea market shopper was going about her day in 2007. And this was a person who was accustomed to finding interesting items at flea markets and selling them back to other customers on eBay. She came across the sack in a bin of rags. And she bought a whole bundle of material for one price. She then discovered the inscription on the sack. She read it. She was astonished. She did some Google searching, and she discovered that Ruth Middleton, the embroiderer, shared a last name with a well-known, wealthy family in Charleston, South Carolina, the Middletons. And these are the Middletons of Middleton Place, which is a restored plantation site and National Historic Landmark. When the flea market shopper discovered this, she got in contact with staff members at Middleton Place, including Tracy Todd, who is currently the president of the Middleton Place Foundation. And she decided to donate the sack to the site. And the foundation now owns it.
You know, there's something both iconic and offensive about this symbol of generations of strong women, or women we can assume were incredibly strong, coming through a history of enslavement, carefully passed down, and then winding up in a rag bin at a flea market. And one of the things that strikes me in the book is the way you talk about the erasure of artifacts and history for enslaved people, versus what we know about white America in that time. And you have to piece together a history from this modest sack. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you put your finger on it exactly. And this was partly the difficulty and the struggle, and quite honestly, the painful aspect of working on this project, recognizing that the trajectory of the sack in many ways seemed to mirror the trajectory of the women who had packed it and passed it down and cared for it and relied upon it. The sack was treated as something invaluable, as something cheap, as something unworthy, as something that could be discarded. And African-American women have been treated in much the same way, especially in the time period when Rose lived and when Ashley lived, and when a Black girl, a Black child could be thought so unimportant that she could be vended away and sold away like an object, like a cow, like a blanket. It's very sad. I had a difficult time working with this material. And there's an irony involved here. The irony is that after all of those decades, all of those years that these women traveled with that sack, and after Ruth Middleton made her way north with this sack and changed her life so that she could live it out in the north, the sack was actually brought back to the South, brought back to a plantation, brought back to a place of incarceration and exploitation. What do we make of this? In many ways.
What do we make of it? Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, not at all. In many ways, and in a strange way, we see the present reflecting the past here. We see that we are still entangled in many of the same power relationships that once existed and that led the sack on its journey across South Carolina into the North.
In our, we have a few minutes left. We have a little time. And so I want to use it to talk about the items in the sack that come that we learn about in the embroidery, because at one level they kind of read like a modest packing list: tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of hair. But you bring them forward as symbols of both want and resilience. And there's something deeply defiant and at the same time feminist about the act of these items and putting them in the sack and what they would have meant to enslaved women of the time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's right. It's a telling list, isn't it?
It is.
It's an evocative list. A tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair, and we can't forget that love was also on this list. So this is a mother's list of things that she could get her hands on, of things that she could control, and of things that she thought her daughter might need. It is a beautiful list because it's material, it's physical, it goes to all of those human needs that we all share, the very basic necessities of life, clothing, food. But it's also symbolic of the ways in which African Americans, Black families, human beings need to connect to one another, need to bind to each other by way of emotion. And so we can certainly read this as a woman's list. You read it as a feminist list. And I can see that interpretation as well. Because in the moment of packing this sack, Rose was taking an action. She was taking a bold and courageous action to change the life of her daughter. She was taking an action that refused to accept the circumstance, the predicament, the system of enslavement.
Professor Miles, sometimes, I was going to say this like it was some wisdom of mine. Let me rephrase. One of the things that I learned in reading your book is that what we don't know tells us a story, too. And what story do the gaps in our knowledge about Rose and Ashley tell?
So many things. We learn through the gaps in the story, the things that we cannot know for sure, because the archival record is so thin, that there are many, many stories that exist that we actually can't access. We only have an impartial sense, an impartial understanding of the past. It is much more complex than we could ever recognize or ever guess. And that's very important because I think it compels us to consider our national past, our regional and local past, and our present time with a little bit of humility. We just do not know. There is much more to be discovered. And I also think that the not knowing, the gaps, compel us to think more creatively, to push ourselves, to try to empathize with people of the past, to grasp for, to search for, and to apply new tools of investigation, and to try to tell capacious stories that leave room for these spaces, for the things that we can't know, and that honor them, and that honor the people who were not able to create records, who were not able to construct archives, and who were not able to write their own stories.
In a sentence, and I say that because I don't want to have to cut you off at the end of this answer, what's one thing that changed in your heart from writing this book?
Through writing this book, I came to realize that to face the emergencies of our present time, we need all hands on deck.
And that is Professor Taya Miles, a history professor and Radcliffe alumnae professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Her book is All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley's Sack, A Black Family Keepsake. Professor Miles, wow, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.